Whenever there is risk, there should be consent. No matter how much the benefits could outweigh these risks, if there is risk involved, the individual should be given a choice, especially in health and medicine. The Nuremberg Code was developed specifically to prevent these interventions from happening without consent. Today, this is a popular topic of discussion, whether or not we have informed consent for a mandated medical intervention. But the truth is, we should have been talking about this for the last 80 years, since the government has been administering a medical intervention without our consent, and for many, even without their knowledge. Of course, the substance I am referring to is fluoride in the public water supply. Many will be quick to assume that anyone who thinks this could be a problem for our health is a nut, a quack, and a conspiracy theorist. I mean, just read any government webpage on the topic. The science is settled. Low-dose fluoride is good for our teeth. In fact, the CDC has put water fluoridation on their list of the 10 greatest health achievements of the 20th century. I gotta hand it to them. It does fit right in with the rest of the list. All of the experts agree that it's the consensus, and for all of these reasons, we should be very skeptical. If you enjoy our content, please consider donating to us through Patreon or one of our crypto addresses, and give us a follow on Twitter and TikTok. All of which you can find in the description. Let's start from the beginning.
Here are the facts.
Fresh out of UPenn School of Dental Medicine in 1901, Massachusetts native Dr. McKay moved to Colorado Springs to practice dentistry. Upon arrival, he noticed the Colorado Springs locals had disgusting brown stains on their teeth, something he had not seen on the East Coast. These stains were permanent and severe, with some residents' teeth looking as if they had been covered in chocolate candy. McKay found no information on these infamous stained teeth in the medical literature, and took matters into his own hands, beginning to conduct epidemiological research on the matter. Most practitioners in the area lacked interest in investigating it, but eventually, McKay garnered attention from local dentists of what became known as the Colorado Brown Stain. He moved to St. Louis, Missouri in 1905 to study orthodontistry, and again noticed the same brown stained teeth in the locals. He then moved back to Colorado Springs and continued his quest for answers. The ball really got rolling in 1909, when esteemed dental researcher, Dr. G. V. Black, decided to see the phenomenon for himself in Colorado. When he first heard about the Colorado brown stain, he did not believe it, as there had been no mentions of it in the dental literature. He went to Colorado because a study the Colorado Springs Dental Society conducted showed that 87.5% of nearly 3,000 local children had brown stained teeth. Upon arrival, Black walked around town and conversed with local children with the intent of studying their teeth. He noticed the condition was blatantly prominent in every group of children. He felt as though the Colorado brown stain was a serious deformity these children were stuck with for life. In that time, McKay and Black made two important discoveries. They found that Colorado Springs residents who had unstained permanent teeth were not at risk for developing stained teeth. However, local children who were waiting for their permanent teeth to come in were at risk of developing the stains. They also found that, despite the residents having grotesque teeth in appearance, these teeth were incredibly resistant to decay. McKay began to theorize that something in the water supply was staining residents' teeth brown, but the mystery was still a long way from being unraveled. McKay's theory was bolstered in 1923, when he met with parents in Oakley, Idaho, who claimed their children's teeth had been stained brown shortly after a communal water pipeline was constructed for Oakley residents. McKay analyzed the water and found nothing unusual, but still advised the borough administrators to abandon the pipeline and use another spring for water. A few years later, the children of Oakley were developing healthy, white teeth. Next, McKay and Dr. Grover Kempf of the United States Public Health Service traveled to Bauxite, Arkansas to investigate more reports of the brown stain. Bauxite was a company town supporting the Aluminum Company of America. Remember the Public Health Service and the Aluminum Company of America because they will be important to the story later on. Upon investigation, the children of Bauxite had the disordered teeth, but the children of neighboring towns did not. The two doctors investigated the water supplies, but again, found nothing peculiar. McKay and Kempf filed a report of their findings, which reached the chief chemist of that aluminum company, H.V. Churchill. Churchill was concurrently trying to dispute claims that aluminum cookware was toxic. He became worried that the happenings in Bauxite would give his opponents more ammo to prove that aluminum was poisonous. Churchill decided to head over to Bauxite and test the water using photospectrographic analysis, a method more sophisticated than McKay's. Churchill's assistant conducted the test of Bauxite's water and found that it had high levels of fluoride. Churchill said to his assistant, "Whoever heard of fluorides in the water? You have contaminated the sample. Rush another specimen." His assistant obliged and did another assay of the water, and again found that it had been contaminated with high levels of fluoride. In 1931, Churchill wrote a 5-page letter to McKay detailing his findings of fluoridated water and instructed McKay to collect samples from towns experiencing the notorious brown stain. Within months of collecting and analyzing water samples, McKay's 30-year mission came to an end. High levels of fluoride in water supplies indeed caused the discoloration of tooth enamel, now referred to as fluorosis. Before this time, it had been known that fluoride was one of the most toxic compounds in Earth's crust. It was also a byproduct of many industrial processes, most notably the production of aluminum. By the 1920s and 30s, it was the subject of multiple regulations and lawsuits. This became very consequential in 1938 because of the aluminum industry's importance due to the Second World War. Also in 1931, the Public Health Service sent dentist H. Trendley Dean to the West to study the effects of fluoridation on people's teeth. He found that towns with higher amounts of natural fluoride in the water had citizens with fewer cavities. He also found that these people's teeth were often discolored and eroded, but I guess that's neither here nor there. The Mellon Institute, the Aluminum Corporation of America's research lab in Pittsburgh, commissioned Gerald J. Cox to conduct a study. He fluoridated his lab rats' drinking water and pretty much just decided that their cavities had been reduced. He rushed to conclude that this was proof of fluoride preventing cavities. Although fluoride was found to prevent cavities, the general consensus at the time was that fluoride was a poison. In 1936, the Journal of the American Dental Association stated, "Fluoride at the 1 part per million concentration is as toxic as arsenic and lead. There is an increasing volume of evidence of the injurious effects of fluorine, especially the chronic intoxication resulting from the ingestion of minute amounts of fluorine over long periods of time." In 1939, Cox, who had been getting paid by an aluminum company facing fluoride lawsuits, came out publicly to propose mandatory water fluoridation. Other bought and paid for scientists did the same. Around that time, extensive studies of thousands of children confirmed that there was also an inverse relationship between regions where the water supply was found to contain fluoride and the rate of tooth decay. Later, other studies showed that towns that switched from fluoridated to non-fluoridated water experienced increased tooth decay. Researchers sought to put enough fluoride in the water where tooth decay would be prevented, but fluorosis would not occur. With more accurate ways to measure fluoride concentrations, it was determined that water fluoride content of less than 1 part per million was enough to prevent tooth decay, but not enough to cause severe fluorosis in most people. This determination was later proved wrong when the CDC analyzed the teeth of the nation's teens and found that 40% of them had some degree of dental fluorosis with cloudy spots, streaks, and even brown teeth and tooth erosions. Interestingly, much of this data had come from places with naturally fluoridated water in the form of calcium fluoride. The manufacturing byproduct that gets dumped into water supplies is sodium fluoride. The metal that binds fluoride is a key determinant of its chemical and biological properties. So to extrapolate that sodium fluoride would have the same effects seems like a convenient oversight. We can also look at the work of Weston A. Price, a pioneer of dental research who became famous for his work in the 1930s. In his book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, he details the experiences of people who transitioned from more traditional diets to industrialized ones. Notably, even without Western dentistry, societies on their ancestral diets suffered very few cavities. Price mainly attributed this to what he called the displacing foods of modern commerce: white sugar, white flour, and vegetable oil. These foods took up space in the diet where nutrient-dense whole foods would normally be, specifically those rich in fat-soluble vitamins that are now known to play a major role in dental health. Another variable that is to be looked at is toothbrushing. Before World War II, brushing your teeth was not a common American habit. However, during the war, soldiers were instructed to brush their teeth. They brought this routine home with them, and that is when toothbrushing became prevalent. During World War II, fluoride lawsuits piled up, and the Journal of the American Medical Association came out and said, "Fluorides are general protoplasmic poisons, changing the permeability of the cell membrane by certain enzymes."
Here's where it gets crazy.
Over the coming years, the Public Health Service would adopt an extremely pro-fluoridation stance. The Public Health Service was under the jurisdiction of the Treasury Department. The Treasury Secretary at the time was none other than billionaire Andrew Mellon. Mellon was the founder of the Aluminum Corporation of America, the biggest firm in the aluminum industry.
And y'all don't have a problem with this? You're just gonna let this slide.
In 1945, after much debate and discussion from public health agencies, a vote passed to fluoridate the drinking water of Grand Rapids, Michigan.
On file with the County Dental Society are statements from members of the medical profession over and over again that they have seen no ill effects from the fluoridation of the Grand Rapids water. The dental office.
Grand Rapids became the town with the first purposely fluoridated water supply in the world. After 15 years of a study of 30,000 Grand Rapids children, researchers found that the rate of dental cavities declined by 60%. In 1947, President Truman appointed Oscar R. Ewing as the head of the Federal Security Agency, which encompassed the Public Health Service. Ewing and the Public Health Service launched the push for mandatory fluoridation and mobilized establishment groups of dentists and doctors. Ewing's goal was to unite the establishment center and the respectable left to advocate against the right-wing anti-fluoridation kooks, such as the John Birch Society, which was outspoken on the matter. To manage the public relations for this campaign, he hired none other than the father of public relations, Edward Bernays. Here comes some more insanity. Before Ewing arrived in Washington, he was the longtime legal counsel, and at the time, chief legal counsel, of the Aluminum Corporation of America. His legal efforts for the company were earning him $750,000 per year, or the equivalent of just under $11 million in today's money. Call me a conspiracy theorist, but this seems like a minor conflict of interest. We could make an entire video on Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, as he changed marketing forever by transforming the public's opinions on topics instead of just trying to sell products. Bernays is quoted saying, "Large numbers of persons will follow the advice of their doctors because he, the PR man, understands the psychological relationship of dependence of man on their physicians." Bernays also said, "If you can influence the leaders, either with or without their conscious cooperation, you automatically influence the group which they sway." Before his campaign, the public thought of fluoride as the main ingredient of rat and bug poison. After, Bernays had convinced the public that fluoride was a safe way to build healthy teeth. After a successful push for water fluoridation, Ewing went back to his lucrative position as head legal counsel for the notorious aluminum firm. In the 1940s and 50s, the pro-fluoridation Satanists were vindicated with the controlled experiment of Newburgh and Kingston. These were two neighboring towns in upstate New York with similar demographics and similar rates of all diseases. Newburgh got the fluoride and Kingston did not. The good news is that 10 years later, Newburgh children aged 5 to 9 had much fewer cavities than those in Kingston. The bad news is that rates of cancer and heart disease in Newburgh were also significantly higher than those in Kingston. A federal study in 1956 found almost double the rate of pre-malignant bone defects in young males of Newburgh compared to Kingston. Anyone who brought attention to these findings were labeled as a kook by the establishment. By the 1950s, 87 U.S. cities fluoridated their public water supply. After the 1950s, two-thirds of the reservoirs in the United States were fluoridated, and the goal of government was universal fluoridation. Between 1960 and 1975, a Mohawk Indian reservation in upstate New York got absolutely devastated by industrial pollution, mainly of fluoride. The offenders were the Reynolds Metals Company and the notorious Aluminum Company of America. The Mohawk cattle were so ridden with bone disease that they couldn't even stand up and had to crawl along the pastures like snails. Many of them couldn't even graze as their teeth had crumbled to the nerves and they were forced to starve. Birds and bees fled the area, and crops and trees couldn't survive. The fish were ulcerated with spinal deformities, and worst of all, Mohawk children had damaged bones and teeth. The Mohawk tribe sued the two aluminum companies for $150 million, but after 5 years, only ended up with a $650,000 settlement. In 1975, two biochemists, Dean Burke and John Ioannis, presented a paper before the American Society of Biochemists. This paper found a 5-10% increase in cancer rates among U.S. cities with fluoridated water. Even with evidence of the harmful effects of fluoride being found, there had yet to be an animal study looking at the relationship between fluoride and cancer. Although their findings were disputed, they triggered a congressional hearing 2 years later in which congressmen were shocked that there had never been an animal study conducted on the matter. Congress then ordered the National Cancer Institute to do so. The National Cancer Institute took 12 years to finish the tests and found unequivocal evidence that fluoride caused bone cancer in male rats. At the behest of Congress, they also found nationwide evidence of increased bone and joint cancer among people of all ages in fluoridated counties, but not in the non-fluoridated counties. In more in-depth studies, the National Cancer Institute found a 70% increase in bone cancer rates among males under 20 in Washington and Iowa drinking fluoridated water. Conversely, males under 20 in the non-fluoridated areas of these states experienced a 4% decrease in bone cancer rates. However, some statisticians disputed the data and called it spurious. This drove the government to pull one of its favorite tricks in the book, forming a commission of bipartisan, world-class experts in 1983. Although the panel was probably under duress, they actually found that evidence of fluoride's safety was scarce. They ended up recommending caution for fluoride exposure to children. They advised that the fluoride in drinking water for children under 9 be no more than 2 parts per million because of worries that it may negatively affect their skeletons and hearts. The chairman of the panel, J.R. Shapiro, funny enough, warned members that the Public Health Service might modify the findings because the report deals with sensitive political issues. When the Surgeon General at the time, Everett Koop, released the report a month later, the government trashed the panel's most important recommendations and conclusions without even consulting them. The government came out and said that there was no scientific documentation that fluoride was harmful under 8 parts per million, completely disregarding the commission. During this time, 8 epidemiological reports had come out displaying a relationship between fluoride consumption and bone fractures in people of all ages. The bone fracture rate in the U.S. had skyrocketed since 1953, and the U.S. became the world record holder for most hip fractures. In 1990 and 1991, another federal commission led by Frank E. Young, Public Health Service official and pro-fluoridation shill, concluded that there was no evidence of a relationship between water fluoridation and cancer. They also concluded that further studies are required to prove that fluoride may cause bone fractures and continued to support universal water fluoridation. Despite the propaganda, there were still some real human beings casting doubts. In 1992, director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Services, James Huff, voiced his concerns on animals in the fluoridation groups of studies experiencing solidly higher rates of cancer. William Marcus, an anti-fluoridation toxicologist, warned that along with cancer and bone fractures, fluoride may also cause arthritis and other diseases. he spoke about an unreleased New Jersey Health Department study. Only 15% of New Jersey's water is fluoridated. They allegedly found that bone cancer rates of young males were over 6 times higher in the fluoridated areas of the state than the non-fluoridated areas. Also in 1992, the Journal of the American Medical Association, which was generally pro-fluoridation at the time, came out and said, low levels of fluoride may increase the risk of hip fracture in the elderly. The group concluded that it is now appropriate to revisit the issue of water fluoridation. Decades prior, it had seemed that fluoride did have a tangible benefit in preventing cavities for children 5 to 9, but even that had been coming into question. Over in New Zealand, the country's top dental officer and chairman of the Fluoridation Promotion Committee, John Calcoon, attempted to prove the doubters wrong by gathering statistics showing the positive effects of water fluoridation. To his surprise, he found that children in the fluoridated parts of New Zealand actually had higher rates of dental decay than children in non-fluoridated areas. The National Health Department then applauded Calcoon and stopped fluoridating New Zealand's water supply. Just kidding, that last sentence was a lie. The National Health Department actually refused to let Calcoon publish his findings and removed him from the dental director position.
Get out.
In a similar situation across the world in Canada, a top fluoridationist in British Columbia, Richard G. Foulkes, came out and said that fluoridation wasn't only dangerous, but ineffective at preventing tooth decay. He was then denounced by former colleagues as a propagandist and a quack. "I was conned by a powerful lobby," said Foulkes. Huge companies processing metals like aluminum were emitting fluoride pollution. This pollution had been poisoning plants, animals, and people since the 1850s and led to many lawsuits and horror stories. These companies didn't want to lose money and hurt their public image. When World War II came around, the government now had an incentive to underplay the harmful effects of fluoride because they needed the metals to wage war on the Axis powers. Both big business and government had an incentive to prove the safety of fluoride. They could actually coerce the legislators to let them dump the fluoride into the public's water supply. Instead of paying to dispose of the fluoride, these companies would be paid to dispose of the fluoride. The plan was as genius as it was evil. An article from 1992 stated, "It might be noted that fluoridation made possible a master public relations stroke, one that could keep scientists and the public off fluoride's case for years to come. If the leaders of dentistry, medicine, and public health could be persuaded to endorse fluoride in the public's drinking water, proclaiming to the nation that there was a wide margin of safety, how are they going to turn around a year later and say fluoride was dangerous?" Does this make you think of something else that's going on right now? Now, over 200 million Americans drink fluoridated water, and fluoride is a component of almost every major toothpaste. More Americans drink fluoridated water than people of every other country combined. Interestingly, or really not that interestingly, countries that don't fluoridate water don't have higher rates of dental decay on average. Other additives are used to treat water, but only fluoride is used to prevent tooth decay. In fact, fluoride is the only medicine that is added to water, and drinkers of it do not have any control over the dosage. Think about it. How can the dose of a medicine be determined by how much water you happen to drink? A man who drinks 12 glasses of water a day gets 6 times more fluoride than a man who drinks 2 glasses a day. Wouldn't it make sense for someone to be able to, you know, choose how much fluoride they get, maybe by brushing their teeth? It's clear now, even to the CDC, that the so-called benefit of fluoride to the teeth comes from topical application. It does not need to be ingested to exert its effects. The fluoride that many of us consume from tap water is not the same fluoride that is put into toothpaste. Toothpaste contains pharmaceutical-grade fluoride, while municipal water supplies do not, because that would be far too expensive. While water fluoridation has its roots in aluminum production, the fluoride in today's water supply is actually a waste product from the phosphate fertilizer industry. To make soluble phosphate for fertilizer, these companies take insoluble phosphate rock and add concentrated sulfuric acid. This causes a reaction that produces 2 hazardous gases, hydrogen fluoride and silicon tetrafluoride. These waste products used to be essentially dumped into the environment by the fertilizer companies, which would decimate populations of fish, animals, plants, and livestock. The EPA then enacted regulations to prohibit these waste products from leaching into the environment. The phosphate fertilizer companies then had to spray water on the hazardous gases to convert them to a liquid called hexafluorosilicic acid. This new liquid cannot be dumped into waterways or oceans because of how harmful it is to the environment, but it can be sold as a product, and sold it was. I think you have an idea who buys this hazardous waste product. Public water suppliers. Instead of paying to dump it, fertilizer companies literally make money off of selling it. So without your consent, your tax dollars go to fertilizer companies to buy hexafluorosilicic acid. And also without your consent, it is dumped into your drinking water. Another problem with hexafluorosilicic acid is it contains trace amounts of lead, arsenic, mercury, and radioactive isotopes as byproducts from its manufacturing process. Keep in mind that, according to the EPA, there are no safe levels of arsenic and lead, no matter how minute they may be. A bonus is that fluoride probably makes people dumber, less imaginative, and ultimately, less likely to resist their own enslavement. I'm not going to get esoteric for too long here, but fluoride is said to calcify and disrupt your pineal gland. Some say that the pineal gland acts like a third eye, promoting spirituality and imagination. According to ancient texts, it allows for higher states of consciousness. So are you going to allow this to happen to yourself and your family? Or are you going to take the steps necessary to prevent this industrial waste from getting into your body? There are two solid options: buying glass-bottled spring water, or buying an adequate filtration system that actually removes fluoride, such as reverse osmosis. Taking it a step further, are you going to let this happen to people in your town? Check to see if your municipality is fluoridated, and know that on a local level, you and your fellow townspeople can make more of a change than you may think. However, your efforts may be futile without proper knowledge and research of this systematic poison. Make sure you stay tuned for the next video, where we'll dive deep into all the problems fluoride can cause in the body. Don't let them give you the fluoride stare, and don't let them fool you. Subscribe to our channel.